You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LP FM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Today, we'll be talking about the environmental dangers of mountaintop coal removal with the Beehive Collective, and we'll have a frank discussion about the ongoing Richmond Symphony contract dispute with musicians involved in the negotiations. But first, here are some of the stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The latest change to a special use permit application for the old Victory Rug building at 407 South Cherry Street still does not satisfy some area residents. The Organ Hill Neighborhood Association issued a press release Saturday outlining their continued displeasure over developer Guy Blendon's Victory Apartments plan, which is currently plotted as a 29-bedroom development, but with only 8 off-street parking spaces. In the release, owner president Jennifer Hancock is quoted as saying that Organ Hill already has a tight parking situation due to the proximity to VCU, and the density and lack of off-street parking of this development would only worsen that. The city categorizes the majority of historic Organ Hill, not zoned for business, as a residential area, but land use administration documents from August reference special riverfront zone ordinances as applying to the parking situation. This is the third set of plans Blendon has submitted. Richmond City Public Schools opened an on-campus daycare center at Armstrong High School this week in the hopes of keeping teen parents from dropping out. The Center for Disease Control reports that only half of teen mothers receive a high school diploma by age 22. Studies published in the Journal of School Health and elsewhere show the beneficial effects of in-school childcare programs for teen parents and their children, not only in the matter of attendance. The 5th annual Richmond Folk Festival kicks off tonight. The free event, which continues until Sunday evening, is the most popular and well-attended festival of its kind in the country, and organizers say that this year's installment may be the best batch yet. Cuban dance music, Argentine tango, Hawaiian hula music, Delta blues, New Orleans jazz, bluegrass, and many other musical styles will be spotlighted on 7 different stages along Richmond's downtown waterfront. The Virginia Folklife stage will also pay tribute to some of the state's musical legends, including Ralph Stanley, Maggie Ingram, Jim and Jesse, and the late John Cephas and Mike Seeger. There will also be workshops on indigenous crafts and food, including oyster shucking, ham curing, apple cider pressing, and moonshine whiskey making. For more information on this year's lineup, including parking and shuttle bus sites, log on to richmondfolkfestival.org. And to get a heads up on this year's must-see performers, log on to the Open Source RVA Facebook page to hear a podcast of our recent interview with Folk Festival Programming Committee members. If by Sunday night you're looking for something a little more rock and roll, Gallery 5 will be hosting the Ladies' Night Benefit Show for the Richmond Reproductive Freedom Project. The RRFP states their mission as seeking to further reproductive justice by providing practical and financial support for abortion services in Virginia and surrounding communities. 8 bands, including White Laces, Fire Bison, Canario Canary, and Julie Carr, will rock out for reproductive rights, and there will be an art auction with pieces from more than 20 local artists, such as Jen Rockwell, Tyler Thomas, Kristen Conover, and so many more. At $2 a pop, raffle tickets will be available for those who want a shot at winning hundreds of dollars in gift certificates from local businesses, bars, and restaurants. Ladies' Night starts at 4 p.m. this Sunday and is $10 at the door. All proceeds go to the RRFP.
The digital divide, you won't find it on any map, but it's perhaps the widest chasm between low-income urban students and their peers in the suburbs. That chasm got a bit shallower this week for students in Richmond Public Schools. City, state, and federal dignitaries, including Mayor Dwight C. Jones and Federal Trade Commission Commissioner Robert McDowell, gathered for a kickoff event at Chimborazo Elementary School in Church Hill for year 2 of the Comcast-led Internet Essentials program. Principal Cheryl Burke kicked things off.
You got to be a leader? So look to my right, your left. Those persons that are sitting in those rows to Mrs. Burke's right, they believe that you will be leaders, great leaders.
The Comcast program offers deep discounts on both broadband services and on computers, focusing on providing affordable high-speed home internet to students from families who live in or near poverty. Somewhere around 80% of students at Chimborazo, as is the case with nearly all Richmond public schools, meet the qualifications for the Comcast program. But the program goes further than just outfitting families with a vehicle for crossing the digital divide. Many families and children who had previously not had access to home internet also need a roadmap, according to Kyle McSlero, president of Comcast NBC Universal. Patty Parks with Richmond Public Library is among the various organizations, including public libraries, the William Byrd Community House, and the Virginia Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, that are providing classes in computer literacy that complement the Comcast initiative.
And this is a huge divide, right, for families that are low-income families.
To
job access, right?
Every person who needs a job anymore has to do it online. And we have a big population that don't have computers at home. And they don't know anything about computers. They're not, you know, they're smart people, but this is just not in an area that they...
It's not an access, it's the access.
Yeah, it's access, and they've never had to do anything like this, so they have to start from learning how to type.
The service, available now to thousands of city students who participate in the free and reduced lunch program, costs $9.95 per month and offers vouchers that bring the cost for a computer down to about $150. More than 1,800 Virginia families participated in the first year of the program.
My pappy said when I was 17, you're 6 feet tall and your face is clean, and it don't look right for a boy that old to not make a living loading.
During last week's presidential debate, Republican challenger Mitt Romney made it a point to mention that he supported clean coal for energy. For those who are fighting the mining process known as mountaintop removal, there's no such thing. Mountaintop removal is the main method of coal mining in the Appalachian Mountains region. It sees coal taken from the top of a mountain or hill, with the fill replaced back on top of the mountain and the excess distributed across the neighboring land. An alarming number of scientists and environmentalists have warned that this practice has serious implications for the environment, and the Beehive Design Collective have been among the most effective protesters speaking out about mountaintop removal. After 2 years of research and preparation, the Maine-based activist group brought their widely acclaimed multimedia presentation called The True Cost of Coal to Richmond last week. I've got members of the collective here with me today on Open Source RVA. Thanks for coming, guys. Do you mind introducing yourselves?
Cool. Well, thanks for having us. I'm Molly. I've been with the collective for about 3 years now and started out doing this work as an effective tool to stop mountaintop removal coal mining.
Great.
Well, hey, yeah, thanks for having us. I'm Ugg, and I've been doing lots of different types of activism over the past 5 or 6 years, and have been kind of flirting around the edges of the Beehive Collective for past 3 years, I'd say.
Right.
Yeah, hi, I'm Tyler, and I joined the group about 4.5 years ago when folks were starting the True Cost of Coal project, which was a lot of research and stuff at that time, and I've been spending most of my time traveling and spreading the stories all over the country.
Great. Tell us, what is the Beehive Design Collective? What is it exactly?
The Beehive Collective is a group of artists and activists and organizers and educators, and we all work together in order to collect stories from the grassroots, from people who are most impacted by environmental, social, global issues from our world today, and we try to highlight their stories, bring them to the forefront, and at the same time use art as a method of telling stories. Mm-hmm. So basically we're storytellers who are working for social change.
Right. Tell me what spurred you all on to explore this subject. It's the True Cost of Coal is kind of a damning assessment of the practice of mountaintop removal. What spurred you on to do it?
We've done other graphics about the drug war in Colombia and about infrastructure development especially super highways and oil and natural gas pipelines in Central America. And, you know, what all of these things have in common with mountaintop removal, coal mining in Appalachia, is that they are all particularly dramatic examples of sort of systemic problems that we see happening all over the world. So we chose mountaintop removal as a sort of lens through which we can better understand resource extraction at large and the sort of the patterns that follow with that type of thing.
Well, for those who couldn't make it out to the presentation, what kind of a program is the True Cost of Coal? You're telling a story. How are you telling it?
Well, we like to use these, we call them portable murals. We have these big graphics that have taken several years to draw, and we use those as an educational tool to tell these stories.
Yeah, so as during our presentations, we lead people through the metaphors and the images in our posters as the three of us are on this particular tour are sort of giving more information, more of the background on where those stories come from, and also connecting all of these small stories together that make up the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Where have you taken the True Cost of Coal presentation, and what's the reaction been in other communities? Before we get to talking about the Richmond show.
We've taken it as far and wide as we possibly have been able to. Mm-hmm. We've gone through a good portion of the United States, probably most of the states. There's certainly some out on the West that we haven't quite gotten to, I don't think, but are working on that right now. Mm-hmm. We have done a little bit of work in like Central and South America with the poster. We were Europe with the poster. We were in Alaska with the poster just this summer. And when we're traveling to all of these different places, we're going to all sorts of different situations too. In this case, we're going to a collective house. Mm-hmm. We just had come from some schools, some universities in Virginia. We went to Hampden Sydney College, the all-men school. Mm-hmm. We go to church basements. We go to protests, after-school programs, kindergarten classes. I mean, we talked to pretty much anyone who is willing to listen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know where I'm going with this. What do people in the Appalachian region think of the show and of your activist efforts?
That's kind of a complicated answer because, as is true of most people, folks in Appalachia don't have one thing that they all believe together, particularly when it comes to coal mining. When we were making this poster, we were talking to a lot of frontline community members, so folks who are both impacted and active on the issue, to sort of hear their stories and tell their stories. And so we have a lot of really strong allies who live in Central Appalachia who I think really value our work and see it as part of a strategy, a national and maybe global strategy.
And I'm guessing you have a lot of people who think you're there just to take away their jobs.
Sure, absolutely. There's a whole other side of this story too of folks who it is their livelihood to do coal mining, and they see us as a direct threat to that, and certainly aren't excited to have us around. But there's also a whole slew of people in the middle too. You know, there's a lot of folks who don't hate us and don't love us, and maybe they don't. You know, there's probably a lot of people who really actually don't care that much about what we're doing.
Yeah.
Or a lot of people who are, you know, anywhere in between. Everything's on a spectrum. And so we certainly see all pieces of that spectrum sometimes. Well, and in Central Appalachia particularly.
If you don't mind, let's talk about the practice of mountaintop removal. What are some of the environmental concerns that you all talk about in the True Cost of Coal?
So basically the coal companies are using millions of pounds of explosives every day at mine sites around the Central Appalachian region to blast apart the layers of bedrock that are sitting on top of the layers of coal. Mm-hmm. Now, to give you a little perspective on this, oftentimes in these areas, the reason that they're doing mountaintop removal is because all the coal that's easily accessible through underground mining has been gotten. And what's left are these layers of coal that are sometimes as little as 2 feet thick, sitting under hundreds of feet of bedrock. So the amount of land that they are destroying and moving and shoving off, mm-hmm. blowing up into little pieces and then then dumping in the valleys to either side, are really huge for a relatively small amount of coal compared to the amount of destruction that's happening. And so basically what's happening as the mountains are getting blown up and pushed over into the valleys is that the high points are coming down and the low points are getting raised up, and this new flat land is being created, and it's totally barren, no topsoil, just bare mm-hmm. rock. It's a really extreme form of mining, mm-hmm. especially for anyone who's been to see one of these mine sites. It's shocking, really. The most devastating effects are not actually what's happening on the mountaintops, but what's happening in the valleys as a result of the valley fills. There's lots of problems with water pollution of all different mm-hmm. kinds. In some places, it's so bad that the aquifer has been polluted, and people's drinking water, people's well water, is coming up poisoned.
Right.
And this is where it gets, where the effects get really, mm-hmm. Really bad for folks.
Who can we credit or blame for the development of this kind of practice? I assume that they do this, the companies do this, because it's cost effective. But who originally came up with the idea of mountaintop removal? What are the origins of this practice?
That's a really interesting question, in part because we spend a good portion of our presentations, and if you look at our poster, there's a lot of history that led up to where we are today. And when you look at it being a cost-effective way of getting coal out of the ground, it's because folks aren't, coal companies aren't paying the true cost of that. There's a lot of externalities, such as water and air pollution, that they're not paying for. But as you sort of look at the history of coal mining in the Appalachian region, you can see the development of mountaintop removal slowly but surely. And you can go all the way back to the story of colonization. When white settlers were coming to the Appalachian region initially and very violently booting people off in order to get the land and get the resources.
Mm-hmm.
And through the years, that's continued to develop in ways of getting more and more coal out of the ground. And you really start to see a huge shift from what a lot of folks think about coal mining, which is underground.
Yeah.
You start to see that shift starting in the 50s and certainly in the 60s and 70s as we see more and more mechanization. And so how we got from underground mining to mountaintop removal coal mining was fairly quick, but nonetheless a transition process, looking at machines like the continuous miner and then the longwall miner and these machines that basically created strip mining.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, even after the longwall miner would mine the outside of the mountains, there was still quite a bit of coal left, and people needed to figure out, how to get the rest of that, those coal seams. And so creating bigger machines mm-hmm. with more explosives was sort of the next step in how to do it. And as we look at coal mining as it continues to sort of, quote unquote, progress, right, as it continues to get bigger and bigger, we continue to see more and more extreme forms of getting it out, whether we're talking about the Appalachian Mountains or what's happening out west or what's happening in Central and South America. I mean, we're on a trajectory that keeps getting more extreme, which also has more and more dire consequences for people living in that area, as well as for our climate and the long-term stability of the place that we all live.
Another part of this story that fits in here, I think it's really interesting that to consider this in terms of the economy nowadays, and especially you mentioned Mitt Romney and how he's in support of clean coal and all this stuff, and Obama was saying that.
Seemed like
ago.
He went out of his way to
I'm
talk
sure
about
he
it.
Did, yeah. And I'm sure it was, it's always tied to, you know, we need more jobs and all of this stuff. But if you look at it, like, say if you were to draw a chart mm-hmm. that showed the amount of coal mining jobs from 1960 to till today, it would be this curve that is exponentially decreasing, because as everything gets mechanized, mm-hmm. it's just putting more and more and more miners out of jobs as the machines get bigger and bigger and bigger. But then if you look at, if you marked on that same chart the amount of coal being extracted and consumed, especially in Appalachia, it would be, well, and really especially in other parts of the U.S., like in the Rockies and in Alaska, where all of this stuff is booming,
Yeah, this would be just a problem in Appalachia, right?
Right. It would be exponentially increasing. And so we see this situation, and we try to illustrate in our graphics this situation where machines and production just for the sake of maximized profit and speeding up and extracting more and more and more and more is taking precedence over people who live in this region and taking priority, I mean to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, y'all are not the only ones speaking out about this. What are some other people doing? Are there other efforts like yours to speak out against the mountaintop removal? Or do you guys feel alone sometimes in this?
There is more and more people every day who are talking about mountaintop removal and working towards the goal of ending mm-hmm. mountaintop removal. Whether we're talking about sort of community groups such as folks here in Virginia with the Southern Appalachian Mountain Stewards, SAMS, out in Wise County, or we're looking at groups like Mountain Justice that mm-hmm. work all over and throughout Appalachia, particularly working with solidarity activists, folks who aren't from the region, to use their privilege to stop mountaintop removal, or for looking at mass mobilizations, folks coming together from all over the country, like what we saw two summers ago with the Battle of Blair Mountain, or we've seen in D.C. Folks are getting louder and louder and louder as this situation becomes more and more dire. And so we're certainly not alone. We're very far from alone. Our movement is growing, and our movement is crossing into other movements. The movement against mountaintop removal is very connected and very similar to any other movement for justice. And we find ourselves in a lot of community and a lot of folks working towards ultimate same goals. But as far as, you know, I think the way that we, the particular way, the venue that we choose to talk about mountaintop removal, there aren't too many other groups that are using art and storytelling as their way. There are some other people who certainly are doing public education, like the Mountaintop Removal Roadshow with Dave Cooper or other folks like that. But we find ourselves in a unique position to really get out and meet a lot of new people who maybe wouldn't have access to this information otherwise.
Right, right. Well, you know, I didn't want to just pick on the Republicans. What's the Obama administration's record on not only mountaintop removal, but on coal as an energy source?
I would say it's been pretty lackluster. You know, I think a lot of folks thought 4 years ago or that the Obama administration was really going to start standing on the side of environmental justice, and folks like Lisa Jackson at the head of the EPA would be taking really strong stances against all of these different forms of injustice. But we've seen the Obama administration do very little to mitigate mountaintop removal, coal mining, or other forms. We've seen a continued push for this fake form of clean coal, which is something that just doesn't exist. We see a huge push from the Democratic Party for natural gas development. Mm-hmm. So when we look at, you know, the two parties that we're told are our only options, that doesn't really feel like an option to me and to, I think, a lot of folks who are fighting extractive industries and who are in many situations fighting for their lives, because neither one are really standing with the people at the grassroots and standing with folks who are trying to look out for the long term for our grandchildren or beyond that.
Y'all mentioned a little bit of this before, but talk about some of the other issues that the Beehive Design Collective has explored.
Well, so this is the True Cost of Coal is the third completed narrative graphic. So the full storytelling graphic that we make. Our first one was about free trade, sort of looking at globalization, just trying to wrap our heads around what those things mean and how they impact our world, who are the powers that be that drive it, and what implications that has for the folks who aren't in power. The second one we put out was called Plan Colombia, and it's all about the war on drugs, particularly looking at United States intervention in Colombia through militarization, as the story goes, trying to prevent cocaine from coming into our country. Well, actually, that hasn't been happening, and I think there are a lot of alternative motivations for Plan Colombia and the mm-hmm. and that war.
Such as? That's intriguing.
Resource extraction is a huge one. We see folks being displaced in Colombia and other places in the South in waves, huge groups of people who can no longer live on their land. And Colombia is an incredibly rich place when you look at resources. And so as folks get moved off, suddenly big corporations, whether we're talking about folks like Nestle coming in with, you know, like things like cocoa and coffee development, or we're talking about oil pipelines, which we see a whole lot of, we get to see sort of some of the other stories that are happening and coming to the surface as we look at the mm-hmm. real implications of the war on drugs, because we haven't actually slowed cocaine trafficking into the United States. And so
right.
that suggests it's not working, yet for some reason we keep doing it.
Where are y'all taking the show next? You're leaving Richmond and going on to where to present the true cost of coal?
Well, we have, after Richmond, after this weekend, we have a week to spend in North Carolina. We're going to Raleigh first. And after that, we're making a long dash out to the Midwest. We're going to do some stops in Wisconsin and Nebraska, a few stops in Missouri, quite a few places. We're actually going to be on the road until about mid-December.
Wow. And y'all started this tour when?
About 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if people wanted more information, not only on mountaintop removal, but on the Beehive Design Collective and its efforts, where would they go?
Well, you can certainly go to our website to learn more about the Beehive Collective, which is this beehivecollective.org. And once you're on our website, you can go to the campaigns to look at the true cost of coal. And one of the resources we provide for people through our educational materials is what we call a narrative booklet. It sort of is the breakdown of the poster using the written word. Mm-hmm. And inside that is a whole list of organizations and allies in Central Appalachia. For folks here in Virginia, I think SAMS, Southern Appalachian Mountain Stewards out in Wise County, is a really great resource. Mm-hmm. And Mountain Justice is probably another good place for folks to look to.
Well, great. Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking with members of the Beehive Design Collective. Their acclaimed presentation on the negative effects of mountaintop removal, the true cost of coal, came to Richmond last week and opened some eyes. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Broadcast of WRAR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, presenting an exhibition of designs for the VCU Institute for Contemporary Art by Stephen Hole Architects, September 13th through October 18th at the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu. WRAR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, call 804-771-5715 or visit www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
There can be nothing on planet Earth as beautiful or as awe-inspiring as a symphony orchestra. Not only does a well-rehearsed orchestra create sounds that are pleasing to the ear, it can also provide a perfect model for what can happen when professional trained artists successfully work and collaborate together in harmony. But these are not harmonious times at the Richmond Symphony. After nearly 8 months of negotiations between Richmond Symphony musicians and management, the American Federation of Musicians Local 123 flatly rejected the latest in a series of contract offers from RSO management last week, an offer that would have meant a sizable cut in salaries and benefits for the players. Even though the music makers continue to perform without a new contract and have not to this point threatened an outright strike, that would seem to be where we're headed here. Patrons to recent concerts were recently greeted with flyers printed by the musicians that filled in symphony patrons to their side of the issue. Richmond Symphony Management's been playing hardball too. Earlier this year, the symphony board used their considerable political influence to convince Republican State Delegate Manoli Lupasi to introduce legislation that would have limited the unemployment benefits that symphony musicians across Virginia would be eligible to receive off-season. This was done to pressure the symphony players, the Richmond Symphony players, a quarter of whom collect benefits off-season, pressure them to agree to their terms. My guests today are Richmond Symphony musicians Molly Sharp, a violist, flautist Mary Boudel, and tuba player Richard Serpa. They're here to talk about the ongoing labor dispute, and it must be said that Open Source RVA has made numerous attempts to have the Richmond Symphony management on the program to speak to this issue, and they've declined. Thanks for coming, y'all.
Thank you.
Not to make too many bad puns about this issue, but the tone of this contract dispute would seem to the outside observer to be getting very dissonant. Is that a correct assessment?
I guess you could say that. This is Molly Sharp, rental violist. Yes, we've been at this, as you said in your introduction, since January, late December, really. We've tried to reach agreement. We have had the management has given us their last, best, and final offer, which we did reject because we feel that it's detrimental to the organization. It's detrimental to us. It's not offering a living wage. But this is not just about the money, actually. This is about the direction of the Richmond Symphony, and the musicians are very concerned because we've seen the direction change and the vision change and in a direction that we are not happy with. And so that is why we're going public, mm-hmm. because we feel Richmond has a great symphony here, and we feel it's a critical time that we could lose the high-caliber symphony we have. And, you know, we're uniquely positioned to offer great symphonic music to the community. We feel we could be doing more. We want to be doing more, and we're not able at this point to do more. In fact, these offerings are being cut.
Well, what were the terms of management's latest final contract offer, and why was the offer not acceptable to the musicians?
Well, it cuts several things. It cuts wages, 7% off the top. It also cuts the length of the season. And so they're cutting it by 2 weeks. So that's 2 weeks that we are not playing together. Mm-hmm. We have a 38-week season last season, and we have for years. So that affects our salaries well. So mm-hmm. when you add that up, then it's more like a 12% cut. We have full-time players. We have per-service players. Their cut is more in the 14% range because they have a salary cut, plus their guarantee has been cut. And then every benefit that we have built over time has been cut in terms of, you know, health insurance, instrument insurance, things that people don't really think about. I mean, but everything
well,
that has a number.
Into that, actually, what it takes to be a symphony musician.
Right.
Mary, the musicians made several concessions to management when it signed its previous contract. Is that right?
That's correct. I think we've had a series of concessions over the years, and I think the musicians have finally come to a place where we say we can't do this anymore because this is no longer viable for the health of the organization in terms of the artistic output that we have. Mm-hmm. And we've done this quietly and in light of not going public previously. Mm-hmm. But the negotiation this time around has really not been a negotiation that was progressing in any way. The first cuts that were asked of us were $150,000. The next cuts were $250,000. The next cuts were over $335,000. Mm-hmm. And now we have an imposed contract with $315,000 plus cuts, plus all these cuts to all our benefits.
Richard, one of the points being made from your side is that reducing salaries will result in musicians choosing not to work for the symphony. Is that true?
It is true, and I think it should be mentioned that the symphony is made up of people who have made Richmond their home, who have come from all over the country and have attended the best conservatories. I can say Mary went to Northwestern, Oberlin, Molly went to the Cleveland Institute, mm-hmm. I attended Juilliard. That's the whole orchestra.
Yeah.
And people have moved here, bought homes, started families here, and have become a real integral part of the community. The musicians teaching students and just giving concerts in other ways outside of the orchestra. Not being able to have a living wage mm-hmm. would actually force people to leave.
For instance, the concertmaster, Diana Cohen, she was here, after 1 year?
One season,
okay. Mm-hmm.
And she went to Calgary.
Was salary the issue there?
I think it was a more stable situation. Yeah. A lot of people, and a lot of the newer people, we have many new players that have come in, our principal bassoon, principal horn, the concertmaster, and they come into this situation and get hit with this, and it's tough.
Right. Well, for the neophyte, tell us how many total musicians that we're talking about here, and also talk a little bit about what the salary range is currently under the old contract, or what it was under the old contract.
Like I said, we have two different tiers of players. The mm-hmm. full-time core, mm-hmm. which is 36 players. The base salary was $32,700 in that range.
Mm-hmm. Wow, y'all are getting rich.
I know. And we've been tracking it against inflation, mm-hmm. and we thought, well, what if we, with all our negotiating and all the fighting, whatever, we are just barely keeping up with inflation mm-hmm. over time. So mm-hmm. we might as well link it to COLA, or the cost of living allowance, and save ourselves the trouble. But, I mean, there's a level you need to make a living wage. On our website, we talk about the living wage project and what you need just to live in the society. We have been hovering at the bottom of that. With these cuts, it puts us below. It's a real struggle. And if you have family, mm-hmm. I mean, it's really hard to put your future on hold like that. So that's our base pay, and that's where we are.
You've said that management wants to limit the symphony's masterworks concerts.
Yes.
And you've cited that as a contentious point in the talks. Why would that be contentious? Well, just for someone who wouldn't know.
The core offerings, I mean, what the Richmond Symphony can offer, and like masterworks, these are symphonic concerts, the meat and potatoes. Mm-hmm. And to us, that's the core of what we do, and everything else radiates from that core. That core is eroding. We don't even have double performances at center stage on the weekends anymore, which we're not even convinced that, I mean, once you've rehearsed an orchestra that week, do as many concerts as you can.
Right. You put the work in, right?
Exactly. We put the work in, so it doesn't make sense to us.
So it's not cost effective as well.
Right. And so we feel like we should be playing. And it's like a sports team. I mean, you have to play together mm-hmm. to maintain. Mm-hmm. And we need to play together as often as we can. And everything else radiates from that.
I said before, symphony management have declined to give their side of this dispute to open source RVA. But Fraser Milner, the symphony's director of advancement and patron communications, did send Angela Lehman Rios at Style Weekly a written statement, and I want to read that. It reads, "We remain committed and hopeful for a resolution that is satisfactory to all parties. We value and applaud our musicians and our staff. We continue to work toward our mutual goal of a strong, vibrant, sustainable organization for years to come." Are the two sides still talking, or have all negotiations stopped?
Negotiations have stopped. We have been given a last best final offer. We turned it down. We did agree to continue to play, but we are no longer in a negotiation. In fact, a letter to the patrons says that the symphony remains open to discussions with the musicians and the union to find a mutual agreement. But that is not an actual fact right now. Mm-hmm. They have said, we are no longer negotiating. Here is our last best final offer. Right. You take it or you don't. And we have decided to play under it mm-hmm. for now mm-hmm. until...
Yeah, right now you currently have no contract. You're
well, we are playing under the last
the
best...
old contract, gotcha.
No, we are not.
No, okay.
No, we are playing under the new terms in the last best final offer. Oh, so we are now at the salary reduction. We are now under all these reduced mm-hmm. Benefits, mm-hmm. Et cetera. Our season has been cut. We have a furlough week coming up where we are not playing and not being paid. So third week of October.
However, the furlough week, out of their generosity, was told it's called an unpaid vacation week.
Okay.
So that makes it hurt a little bit less,
yeah,
I guess.
Right, yeah.
Well, and we'll still be working that week because we have to practice. We'll still be working.
right. Even though it's a vacation, right? Unpaid vacation.
Doesn't work that way.
Now, I assume that if the symphony musicians are being asked to take a sizable pay cut and have their benefits slashed, that symphony management was also willing to accept cuts in their own salaries and benefits. Would that be a correct assumption? Or
we've been told they've had some cuts, and they've written in letters 2-5% cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Eliminating and combining staff
positions, mm-hmm. so we don't fully know the extent of that beyond what we've been told.
And something that should be mentioned, the management is telling the patrons that the musicians haven't been involved in any of the cost-cutting measures, and that the staff has been taking all of these cuts, and that is the furthest thing from the truth. In fact, one egregious example, we had negotiated for 1 year to have a 5% wage increase, and they just said, sorry, we're not paying you. And we actually filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. It was so, they didn't even have to go to hearings. It was so obvious. And management came to the musicians at that point. And once again, this is an example of us being very cooperative. And they said, we can't let this go public because it will affect fundraising. We're all team players. And we thought, yeah, absolutely. And we agreed to cut that in half. There are so many other examples where the musicians have participated. Like at one weekend, we donated all of our services to the orchestra. Everybody played for free, and it came out to a total of in excess of $30,000. And it hurt a lot of people, but we really care about the organization, and we think what we do is very important to the city of Richmond.
If you would, can you address the notion that seems to be very popular with some that what you all do is easy and you should just shut up and accept what's offered to you? One online comment I read was actually kind of comical. It read, they do realize they play instruments, right? They should be happy that they're even able to work full time doing this. Now, how do you address that feeling, and what does it really take to be a professional symphony musician? You want to tackle that one first, Molly?
I just want to say it's frustrating and sad to have to justify what you have chosen to do with your life. Just because you enjoy something means you shouldn't get paid for it. I've been playing a musical instrument since I was in kindergarten. You have to decide early. It's a discipline. I mean, it's like being an athlete. It's something you show up every day, and it looks effortless and it looks easy because we have practiced and practiced and practiced, and we've continued to practice. I mean, I thought once I finished college, it's like, then I would know how to play and then I'd be done. But no, right, I mean, right. It's a lifetime. It's almost like a spiritual practice. It's like the fixed point that you just have to show up every day and work on it.
I can say a personal anecdote. In fact, these guys knew because I called from New York this past weekend. I invested $500, went up to New York, hotel room, and this goes into what our instruments cost. I took two of my tubas up there, of which I own four, and had some work done by a master repair person up there. And at the same time, I went and took a lesson with the tuba player in the New York Philharmonic and hung out with him. And then we went back to his house, and then we also did more stuff to my instruments. So it's never ending. You can talk to orchestral musicians that are 65 years old, and they say, I'm still learning every day, and I'm still working on improving. It's just a never-ending process, and it's a constant investment. Like I said, I dealt with driving up there, and these guys, I slept about, in 2 days, I slept about 5 hours between driving and getting up there and, you know, the whole thing.
Mary, is it just a misunderstanding? People really don't know what it takes?
I think that's true. I think certainly anyone married to a musician could tell you that it's not an easy job because we work many hours a day, every day, really. And also just the physical commitment you have to maintain the everyday use of your body playing an instrument. There's always overuse issues and such. So there's a great deal that goes into keeping our skills up, the daily practice, keeping our training up, you know, additional study and exploration, and then the basic learning our music that we turn over every week, and keeping our health up because of the incredible...
The physical exertion actually is something that I didn't think about for a long time.
Right. And I think one of the other things to know is symphony musicians, the Richmond Symphony, we have Mondays off, but we work Tuesday through Sunday. Really, they can schedule us 8 a.m. in the morning through late at night. Often we're doing a run out somewhere or playing in a school in the morning, doing an afternoon rehearsal. The schedule changes on a daily basis, and that's one of the great challenges and one of the great commitments the symphony players give to this community is that incredible availability. But on the other hand, it's a challenge because it's very hard then to make additional salary even teaching because the schedule changes all the time. And so often musicians are also working on their day off.
What about the notion that classical music's less popular, so therefore all expenses have to be cut, salaries have to be cut to accommodate that? Address that.
Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, you can look at articles from the 50s in which they said the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And during the 60s is when you started having full-time orchestras. So this is an ongoing argument that's existed probably as long as symphony orchestras have existed, and nothing could be further from the truth. One thing that we are concerned about, in addition to the symphony offerings, but also our pops audiences and actually reaching out to the different demographics, is really important to us with the full symphonic ensemble. An example we can give you, I guess right now, you think of the people, the demographics that would have, they're in a point in their life where they have more money and they can afford mm-hmm. to do these things, people in their 40s, 50s. Right. We recently did a Queen concert with a group that...
Right, right. Now, those are very popular, those
sold
sort of
out.
Symphonic rock
yep.
concerts. And mm-hmm. you're exactly right. All of those, they have Yes, yeah. Journey, mm-hmm. all this other mm-hmm. stuff. And the concert sold out.
We're happy to play that. I mean, we want to play and perform, and that's a great example. We're not saying, oh, we only have to do Beethoven. No, we just want to play.
Right. We feed off the audiences. Mm-hmm. And even our opening Masterworks season, we have been told that a composer like Mahler is something that the audience wouldn't want to hear. It's too heavy for wow. to hear the Mahler's First Symphony, and we had the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto. When there's great programming, the people come, and there are so many other variables why they avoid those things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We also have a lot of examples around the country where orchestras are thriving, where people are. You know, the marketing is such, and the programming is energized, and the soloists are great, and they're getting in a whole new young crowd. And we see certain orchestras that are really thriving. And so there might be two things going on in the country, other orchestras in trouble. But we know that Richmond can have a thriving orchestra. And I think the musicians are so excited when they come here and see the rich cultural offerings that this town has.
Mm-hmm.
The arts community, the ballet, the Virginia Museum. There's just so much going on. You know, one of the greatest public art schools in the country. Mm-hmm. And so this is an arts city. And the musicians here say, okay, we can be a part of this. And we want to have programs that are for the city of Richmond and the surrounding counties. And our programs have been cut significantly. When I came in the 90s, we did 12 Pops concerts, 10 Masterworks doubles, 8 Chamber Orchestra doubles, doubles meaning a repeat performance. And now we're down to 4 Pops and 7 Masterworks, half of which are not doubles. And there's a real shift in the balance of our offerings to the city.
Talk about the symphony's artistic endowment. Isn't this put in place to help the artists?
In fact, their mission is to support the Richmond Symphony.
Yeah,
and what we've encountered is that fundraising has been more diverted towards the endowment. They had a recent drive of $5 million is what they were hoping
mm-hmm.
to raise.
Now that,
they raised 5.6.
I'm told that exceeded expectations,
yes.
right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
and what the big issue is that there was no fundraising for our daily operating expenses. And typically when you want to invest in an endowment, you need to clear whatever debt you have before you even start thinking about that. The other unusual thing about our endowment, which is very rare, is it's 100% restricted.
Explain.
Very often endowment gifts can be given in which it's all restricted, and the interest that mm-hmm. comes out of that endowment would be used towards the orchestra, or it can be used for daily operating expenses.
Right.
But it's 100% restricted to prevent it being used for daily operating expenses, and also in the event that anything happens to the orchestra, like this sort of a situation,
mm-hmm.
that money is completely separate from what goes on in the orchestra, even though their primary mission is to support the Richmond Symphony.
Yeah, so we feel that's one of our big questions is, obviously you were able to raise this money even during the financial crisis, because this ended in 2011, the endowment drive. They've shown they can raise the money, but why can't you do it for operations and to the detriment of the everyday operations
and
offerings?
And I assume y'all have asked this question during negotiations.
Yes.
Well, talk about the legislation that was introduced by State Delegate Manoli Lupasi last year at the behest of the Symphony Board. Drew McManus of the blog Adaptastration, which covers the orchestra business, said that the letter that the board wrote was one of the most amazing things he'd ever seen from come from a symphony board. Now, this legislation didn't pass, but many saw it as an attempt to pressure the musicians to agree to management's terms. Do you agree with that view?
I would say yes, and it
was, said so in the letter.
And it was also an attempt to use the legislature and state law to negotiate a contract. They saw it as a savings of $70,000 to prevent that from happening. However, the entire United States was watching this, and it really put a black eye on the state of Virginia and our management, because it was going to affect, in addition to the orchestras within our state, but the entire country.
How would it have affected the Richmond Symphony musicians specifically?
It would have prevented us from being able to collect unemployment during weeks where we're not employed like any other job. And to be honest with you, the musicians really would prefer not to. We all look for work around the country. During the summers, when we're not working at different festivals, mm-hmm. you know, can teach. However, some people in the orchestra, it's like any other job,
right.
there just is not work available. The idea of using the legislature to negotiate a contract was absolutely crazy, and the musicians weren't portrayed in the best light to the legislature and also in the press. It really scarred the musicians that our own management felt that way about us.
Now, where do y'all see this going? If it isn't resolved soon, are y'all prepared to go on strike?
That's a good question. I think we're taking one day at a time. Our hope right now is to go to the community and say, we have a special orchestra. We want to be your orchestra, and we want you to know about us.
Right.
And that's why the musicians have created our own website, rsomusicians.com. On that site, you can get a lot of information about not only the negotiation, but much beyond that. We have concert calendar on that site. We have frequently asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
We have interviews with musicians. We have bios.
I was going to say, this is what symphony subscribers and patrons can do to offer their 2 cents worth.
We
be informed, and mm-hmm. but how can they speak out? Is there a comment section?
There's also a section, a link, where we are asking them to send a letter of mm-hmm. support mm-hmm. to let us know that they care about the orchestra. Really, we need the community to give us a group standing ovation
right.
and say, here, we do want a symphony, and we do believe in a quality symphony. And that's what we're hoping for right now. And we're taking it one day at a time.
Right. Anything we've left out of this, of your side of this issue?
Well, you know, one thing that I think should be pointed out is that a symphony orchestra is not a burden on the community. Mm-hmm. We actually enhance the community dramatically just having these people here. But in addition, you can look at, for every dollar that's invested in the arts, you get a $7 return in how it supports the businesses. I mean, it just snowballs. And when you have corporations in town or corporations that look to relocate, Amazon just built that huge hub and Altria is based here. One of the things that they look at is what kind of a life that their employees
are.
Exactly. Right, yeah. And one of the big things they look at, in addition to sports teams and things like that, is what kind of an art museum do they have? What kind of a symphony orchestra do they have?
So this goes to economic development as well as the arts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you for clarifying my thoughts.
I'm Don Harrison, and my guests today on Open Source RVA have been Molly Sharp, Richard Serpa, and Mary Boudel. They are Richmond Symphony Orchestra musicians and members of the Musicians Negotiating Committee, all three of you?
Yes.
We've been talking about the ongoing labor dispute with Richmond Symphony Management. You can look for more information on this issue at the Open Source RVA website. Thanks again for being here, y'all.
Thank you.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, October 12th, 2012. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi. Our board op is Rachel Solomon. This and past episodes of Open Source RVA are now available for your listening pleasure in your own due time. Head to our Facebook page, where you'll find links to this and other fine episodes of Open Source RVA, as well as to info on the news and music we feature each week. And while you're there, don't forget to like us. Got a news tip? Care to give us a piece of your mind? Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. We'll be back here, wherever here is for you, next week for another edition of Open Source RVA. And one last item of business, happy 12th birthday to my very own Maddie Dobie.